just possibly, given priority over undiluted industry greed. This is Jim Hightower saying, to stay informed on these developments and to help push for environmental sanity, go to ilovemountains.org.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
You're listening to 89.5 FM KOPN Columbia, Mid-Missouri's source for in-depth news, diverse talk, and music of the world. It's more than radio, it's community radio, on the web at kopn.org. Welcome to Thought Crime Radio. I'm Rich.
And I'm Janelle.
And we are voices for the human rights of babies.
Yay. So, here we are again.
Kind of corny, huh?
Yeah. Can you tell people what this Thought Crime Radio is about?
Well, we've been spending the past several months talking about nothing but birth trauma and related subjects and the impact of birth trauma on the individual for oftentimes for the rest of their lives, and how this is having a major impact on the stability and livability of our society.
What does that have to do with Thought Crime Radio?
Well, medicine is one of those hallowed institutions that no one questions, and It's heir to centuries, essentially, of accumulated corruption, unfortunately, because particularly in things with respect to things like circumcision, you can't expect medicine to admit that they got it wrong. There's over 100 million circumcised men in this country, and the legal liability of admitting that something is wrong with this whole idea is just is too much for any self-interested institution to admit.
And so you mentioned birth trauma, and then you mentioned circumcision. So if that's the case with both of them, all of the things that are happening right now to women and babies and even men in the birthing of their babies is sort of...
It's governed by institutional interests instead of science or medicine or human rights, unfortunately.
And last week we spoke with Pauline Dillard, Dr. Dillard from Colorado Springs, and she's done research on postpartum depression and specializes in that with postpartum depression after cesarean, and we talked a little bit about birth rape. And I know that's a really charged label. And we talked a little bit about how women who have been raped are really angry at women when they say that they were raped during their birth. And we didn't really get into it that much, but we're going to talk about that some more at some point in our radio show. But it was of particular interest to me because of I was able to identify that my first birth as a woman giving birth was like a rape, and it was 25 years later. And so what you were talking about with the medical professional system is very, very, very important to talk about, because when you say, like, I had the experience of feeling like I was violated to that degree, but the medical professional will say that they're doing the best they can, and I think they are. But it's a very charged term for medical professionals to feel that, to hear that what they did under their training and their best intentions could be experienced by the woman.
Having the best of intentions is not enough. I'm sorry, but the human body is a organic, you know, process which has certain internal logic to it. And if you ignore that logic and just start delivering babies through surgery all the time, you're ignoring millions of years of evolution and all of the good things that can happen with a normal natural birth.
Right.
So they're just not asking the right questions. They're asking, oftentimes they're asking how to overcome the consequences of their own interventions. How to compensate for that.
Well, I'm really excited today to have Dr. Stuart Fishbein from the L.A. area with us, and he's an obstetrician who I say is he has such a wisdom and an awareness of midwifery. He's a big supporter of midwifery. He's looking into breech birth. He's a supporter of VBAC, which is a vaginal birth after a cesarean, and he's supporting women to make choices. And I think today we're probably going to talk a lot about informed consent. I know that when I was giving birth, I was induced against my will or without knowledge. I was given scopolamine, and then it just cascaded into some pretty horrific experiences for me. And right now women are being told that they have informed consent. And I think Dr. Fishbein will, from a doctor's perspective, will give us a whole new insight into informed consent. So I'm really excited that he's with us today.
Are you there, Dr. Fishbein?
Nope, he's not. I haven't.
Oh.
I wasn't ready yet.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. He should be now.
Doctor, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
I can.
There we go.
How you doing?
Hey, thank you.
I am well.
Joining
Thanks
us.
For that very nice introduction, Janelle.
You're welcome. I was common sense obstetrician was the phrase I was trying to pull up, because that's whenever I talk to you, I think this is such common sense. Finally, it's amazing to hear an obstetrician talking the way we've been talking for a long time in the natural birth field.
Well, thank you. I feel like I got a good upbringing from my parents, and and gave me a good background in common sense and not thinking by pure ideology alone, but letting evidence and experience dictate your decision-making process. And unfortunately, listening to your introduction, I heard a lot of truths coming out of Rich's mouth regarding the system that we try to work in. He mentioned something about 100 million men have had circumcisions and that legal liability will prevent anybody from ever admitting that they shouldn't be doing them. And quite frankly, he really hit the nail on the head when he said that, because there is so much things that could change, that common sense would dictate would change, things that evidence-based medicine would dictate should change things, but we're kind of entrenched in an ideology and a fear of making those changes, partly because of the paralyzation that occurs from our legal system. And if I can digress for a second, I was listening today to the news about this bomber, this foiled bomber on this airline, and our government's response to the bomber or to the attempted bombing is worse than probably than the whole experience with the bomber, as far as I'm concerned. And it kind of exemplifies what we deal with, those of us who seem to be what I would call enlightened regarding that the birth is a natural process and not a disease, is that the response of our government is going to be to tell people they can't get up for an hour at the end of the flight, they can't have anything on their lap for an hour at the end of their flight, they can't know that the Grand Canyon is out the window at the end of the flight. This all seems to be overkill and overreaction, all based on the idea that I guess they need to put on a show that they're doing something. And I think this goes on in hospital settings and in boardrooms and government agencies throughout the country that try to determine when there's an error in medicine or when there's a bad outcome in medicine that they can actually legislate out an error. But by doing that, by that frame of thinking, all they're doing is limiting the freedoms of choice that Americans have, and in my specialty that women should have.
So
you weren't digressing at all. That's exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about this big global connection between some of the silly, crazy things that go on in our world and in our planet, and how the beginning of life, how we treat a baby and how we treat a mother, and how we impose upon them at the beginning of life are very connected.
Well, you know, it's a combination of things, but I think we live in a society where if there's a bad outcome someplace, it gets front page news, and we live in a society that is quick to sue, and even if it's only a small fraction of the population that would sue, the response to those people getting sued is to, you know, get their guard up, get the hackles on their back up, and say, you know what, I'm not going to go through that. I'm not going to give people choices, because if I give them choices and they choose wrong, they're going to blame me. So until that changes, until some mentality changes, or until our medical legal system changes, the things that we would like to see happening are only going to happen in small increments and not on a massive scale. But sooner or later, something will cause change to occur that, as Malcolm Gladwell likes to put in his book Tipping Point, will cause a tipping point, and hopefully people will see that there's another alternative out there to what's being offered right now.
It seems like there's a lot of traditional knowledge that has been lost by obstetrics that has been, you know, accumulated over thousands of years by midwives. Can you go into some of that?
Yeah, I mean, there's two models of obstetrics that I've been exposed to in my training, and obviously one is the obstetric model that you taught in residency programs, and it really goes on at, you know, high-intensity hospitals and is now kind of filtered down to every hospital. And then there's the midwifery model, where the midwifery model treats pregnant women as if it's a natural function of their body, and it works right most of the time, and you just nurture it along, and if something needs a little help, then you give it help. Whereas the obstetric model treats pregnancy as if it's a disease. The whole idea of giving birth in a hospital was only something that's happened since the late 1950s, and it's evolved that way. Birth didn't used to be in a hospital in most places. I mean, they may have had women's hospitals or things like that, or maternity centers, but most people gave birth at home.
In Europe, this is commonplace. Home births are commonplace. It's my understanding.
Much more so than here.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think that's a part of their culture, maybe a part of their legal system. part of the fact that that in a socialized medical system, which most of Europe has, midwives make a lot more sense. They're less expensive. They give better care, and when the government is paying and actually paying attention, then having a lower C-section rate, a lower newborn intensive care unit admission rate, all lowers costs. But for some reason in this country, we have a healthcare in the hospital setting, which is 99% of births in this country, is economically driven, and all the economic incentives are on the wrong side.
They are ignoring also the untoward effects of this systematic traumatization of babies.
And mothers.
And fathers, too,
right.
Yeah, I mean, this is responsible for a huge amount of social dysfunction in this country. And, you know, billions of dollars are spent every year trying to compensate for the consequences of this in terms of treatment for addiction and crime, violent crime.
Well, the whole issue of the mother-child bonding being disrupted and how that is a core issue in almost all of our social behavioral issues between mother and child.
And you know,
I couldn't agree more. I agree with you guys.
I can understand the economics, you know, behind circumcision and premature cord clamping and induction and
C-sections, pit to distress.
Yeah, but what I don't understand is the impetus, the seemingly irresistible urge to separate the mother and baby, right at birth for hours, you know, many hours. At a time when the baby is imprinting everything. And do you have any insight into this? Where did this come from? Why are nurses and doctors so in a rush to get the baby away from the mother?
I do have insight into this. Obviously, it's my opinion, but it's based on 27 years of observation and experience. If I can bring it back to my own community, we have an issue in my own community where I work at two hospitals. One hospital has a newborn intensive care unit in it, and the other hospital has no nursery at all. And obviously, with my collaborative midwifery practice, we like to deliver at the hospital with no nursery at all, because then there's no place for the babies to go but stay with their mother. What I've seen in hospitals that tend to have intensive care nurseries or pediatrics or, you know, respiratory teams available is that there's an economic incentive to use them. And so I think that the nurses that mean well in labor and delivery, sometimes if the baby comes out and it's a little bit floppy, the initial teaching that's taught in medical schools and I'm sure in nursing schools and in training programs is to hit the button on the wall, and in comes the team from the NICU. And that starts, talk about a Pitocin cascade, this starts a whole cascade of interventions on a baby. And by definition, if the NICU team comes to a delivery room, they basically have to then watch the baby for 4 hours at least at this institution that I work at before the baby can then go back to the mother. This is all, and I think this is all comes from two things. One is, again, getting back to that economic liability sort of thing. And one is fear. Okay, it's a fear of being wrong, the fear of a nurse not noticing something. It's an institutional fear that tracks down, because if you are a nurse in an institution and if you think the baby's fine and you ignore something about the baby because the mother wants the baby and something happens to the baby, the amount of paperwork, the number of meetings, the number of hearings that you'll have to go to be reprimanded for not following protocol written by, of course, bureaucrats, not actively practicing physicians generally, puts too much pressure on people. So there's an economic incentive, and there's a fear of liability, and a fear, not only that, of being reprimanded, or a fear of being wrong. And this has been pervasive since I've started. And again, it just defies more than common sense. It's essentially where, you know, we are educated to believe and learn and do certain things, and then for some reason we come out and we're not allowed to exercise our knowledge. We're trained in all these things, but then then all these protocols are written, and then we follow these protocols, and eventually we become more sheep than shepherds. And I think that's true for everyone that works in the healthcare system. And those of us that tend to be resistant to that tend to be labeled as, you know, troublemakers or rabble-rousers or whatever, because it's a classic way of of marginalizing somebody who has a different opinion. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I do know that because of you being so outspoken, that you've had some challenges yourself about being one of those rabble rousers.
Yeah, well, the hospital has, again, in my community, come down on me in a way that they haven't come down on anybody else. And without getting into too many specifics, I mean, you know, our hospital doesn't allow VBACs. They have a policy against it. And occasionally I have a patient who refuses to have a C-section. And when I bring her to the hospital or she shows up at the hospital, I have to take care of her. But then, of course, they can't get mad at the patient because that wouldn't look good. So they come down on the doctor who even gives the person that choice in their informed consent speech. This is a good segue to the informed consent issue, which you talked about earlier. I'd just like to add about breaches, though. I mean, I did 3 breaches in June this year. All had good outcomes. And I was told by the hospital that I can't do them anymore. And even though there's no policy at the hospital, and I am credentialed to do breaches at the hospital, they have just singled me out as somebody who, to not do breaches anymore. They obviously, no one else does them at my hospital. There's one other physician in the community that does them. But they have what they consider to be a community standard, which is if we don't do it, you can't do it.
Just to get the terminology down, could you explain what a breech birth is?
Oh, sure. I'm sorry. A breech birth is where the baby's butt comes first. And normally babies come head first. And there's been a lot of, voodoo applied to a breech birth, saying that, you know, they're dangerous and that the best form of delivery for a breech would be by a cesarean section. There was a paper that came out in 2004 that kind of skewed their data. I don't know if they did it intentionally or not, but the data was reevaluated 2 years later at a follow-up of all these babies, and they found that there was actually no difference in the births that were born breech versus the ones that were vertex when certain things like anomalies and twins and prematurity were taken out of the equation. And if you select your breeches carefully, the babies that are butt first, certain candidates are very good, certain women are very good candidates for labor and should be given that option. And as an informed consenter, even if I wasn't someone who did breeches, and right now there's no place I can do them, but I still think that if you're going to be an honest, Hippocratic doctor, you need to tell a patient that that's an option, and although I can't do it or I don't do it, you know, there are other places in the community or in the city that might, so you should check those out. That would be honest, true, informed consent.
Do they teach handling breech births in medical school these days?
Not these days, no.
But you learned, right?
Yeah, when I was a resident, we were doing pretty much anything and everything in those days. And, you know, I grew up with people in my generation who were very comfortable doing breech deliveries. But again, the training and the such, because of the fears of the medical legal world, this paper that came out in 2004, they've essentially been eliminated, so no one's learning to do them anymore. And without that skill, it's going to be tragic in some way because the C-section rate will only go up. And then there will be women who inevitably show up in labor with a baby's butt pretty much sticking out of the vagina, and no one's going to know what to do. And that's going to be a real disaster because they're not going to know what to do in those situations, and those babies are going to, you know, suffer badly.
Well, and along with that, I want to make a point that you just said that you indicated that as a doctor, you can assess which of your patients would be a good candidate.
Yeah, there are strict criteria that I follow, and they're very easy. Again, I don't want to get too technical in the sake of time of our show. But there are strict criteria that if a woman meets these criteria and the baby meets these criteria, that a trial of vaginal breech delivery is as successful, has the same outcomes that a head-first baby would have.
So that's the same thing that we've been talking about on many levels in the medical care, about it's the insurance companies and legal analysts and hospital policymakers who are telling you, the doctor, what you can and cannot do, regardless of what a baby and a mother need.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's exactly true. What happens is that even though something like the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, an organization to which I belong but I don't always agree with, they have a paper that says that selected breech deliveries should be based on the desire of the mother and the experience of the practitioner. They don't say that selected breech deliver, that all breech delivery should be delivered by a cesarean. Okay. However, if a hospital and their lawyers interpret that to mean that, you know, if we do a breech delivery and there's a bad outcome, we're going to be sued, so we're going to ban them at our hospital, then I don't have a facility where I can do them. So it doesn't matter that I'm qualified to do them, that the American College says I can do them, if the facility ultimately has absolute control about what goes on under their roof. And that never used to be that way. The hospitals used to be doctor-run and doctor-driven. Now they're businesses run. They're run by businessmen and administrative-type people whose really only job is sometimes, I know this sounds bad, but their only job is to justify their job.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So they make rules, and then they make rules that are impossible to follow.
So before you get into the informed consent, I had this burning question. It's come up a couple of times while you're talking. You talk about the litigation issue and how a lot of these things are done to protect from litigation. But then the things that are being done themselves are known scientifically to not be safe or not be the best. And I can't seem to reconcile that.
Well, I can't either. And I'll tell you that it'll be really interesting someday when women who've had cesarean sections for dubious indications and then been denied vaginal birth after cesareans and then suffered some consequence down the road because of having multiple cesareans, such as a very bad outcome in a subsequent pregnancy or chronic pain or whatever else, I can't imagine in this country that there won't be a group of trial lawyers that find a new cottage industry and start to turn around and sue for wrongful cesarean as opposed to, you know, what goes on now, which is for not doing a cesarean. It's got to come, unless there's some sort of reform. It's got to come. You can't reconcile it. I mean, there are more than 30 complications to cesarean section, and there are only about 4 to vaginal birth. And although some are small and some are large, the bottom line is the decision does not belong to the institution. It does not belong to the lawyer. It does not belong to the practitioner. The decision belongs to the woman, okay? But we have usurped that. We've kind of brainwashed people into thinking that, you know, if you mention breech babies to most people in America, they'll automatically, if they know what it is, will say, well, don't you have to have a cesarean for that? Because that's been what they've been told.
Well, we're to the point where if you say you're going to have a baby, people don't think you can do it without an epidural.
They don't think you can do it without, and if you tell them you're going to do it naturally, they think you're crazy.
And Pitocin. Pitocin is a brutal thing to do to a baby.
And to go up to 40 weeks, oh my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, if you go 2 days overdue, you're being induced. Now, in defense of Pitocin, Rich, there is an indication for it, and Pitocin in and of itself is not the devil. It's the use of it and how it's used that's the devil. Maybe you disagree with me, but it is indicated in some
situations. I have to defer to your wisdom.
Okay, thanks.
But it was my understanding that many problems in delivery are caused by epidurals, and that's when they start using Pitocin.
Oh, it is. As Danielle mentioned earlier, there's a whole cascade that starts. You know, the pit to distress business is a fact.
Right.
It is a fact. It doesn't happen that often. But if it happens at all, it's too many times.
So you're saying there's currently no legal framework for recognizing the harm of traumatizing babies because the evidence for it, you know, is difficult to prove in court.
That would be true.
Oftentimes, it doesn't even show up for years.
That would be true, and there would be a lot of experts. And I mean, the way our legal system works now is you have to find experts to testify to that there is damage, and then they'd have to be countered by the experts lining up to testify that, you know, Big Brother knows best.
But the thing is, we know the science. The science is down. I mean, as far as the science is concerned, these are facts, you know, and it just somehow hasn't filtered into the legal community, I guess.
No, it hasn't. I mean, when I have delayed court clamping at my deliveries, and I've been approached by some of the pediatric people at my hospital asking me why I do that because these babies' hematocrits are too high. And my question is I'm not milking the cord into the baby. The baby's blood is circulating in the placenta, so I don't think that delayed cord clamping changes a baby's hemoglobin unless you're talking about putting it back to where it belongs.
It seems to me we need to go back to square one and just observe how other mammals give birth, because that's probably the closest ideal model to what a human birth should look like.
That's an excellent point. And I say that to patients all the time. I say, a deer does not go into the middle of a freeway to give birth.
Well, and then I look at it in terms of the immediate cord clamping has been going on for years, and when you start leaving the blood in, or the placenta and cord intact, and you're going to have a redder baby. Sometimes caregivers don't even know that it's good that a baby is red. So they're looking, what they thought was normal was actually abnormal. So when they see normal, they don't know normal. And maybe there's something going on.
That may be true. But there's so much data to support delayed cord clamping. And there's really no data other than habit, okay, to support early clamping. I mean, on rare occasions, and again, I think I said this on one of those internet interviews, I think we might have talked about, where there's a rare occasion where if a baby is premature or severely depressed and there's no pulse pressure in the cord whatsoever, that baby needs to be given over to the experts. But
the key there being the baby is clearly not getting cord blood.
That's right. And it's clearly depressed. And we're not talking about, but this cord clamping stuff has become, it's routine for every baby that's born. I mean, the first thing that happens when a baby comes out is the obstetrician, in my experience, in my training and stuff, the obstetrician's turning around fumbling for the clamp while he's trying to hold on to the baby.
Yeah,
he doesn't even put the baby on the mother's chest or anything. He's just holding the baby, fumbling for the clamps to put the clamps on the cord. And no one asks why. I mean, you brought it up, Rich. No one takes a stop, take a breath, and say, why?
It's scary to think that there's been a steady decline in IQ scores in mathematics and science in the United States since hospital births became commonplace.
Lack of oxygen?
Probably.
Well, we do sometimes have what we call the dumbest generation in power right now, so who knows exactly what's going on. But, there was Thomas Paine, that famous guy from the Revolutionary War times, he said something to the effect that, the habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it the superficial impression of being right. And the reason that no one thinks cord clamping everyone thinks it's right, is because no one stops to think that, wait a minute, why do we do this? What's the hurry? You're right, in other species, they don't bite the cord in half right after birth. Babies are usually born attached to their placenta. The mother chews it off later, doesn't it? Isn't that what happens in nature?
I think that's what dogs do.
Well, and this organ that's been building this baby, keeping this baby alive throughout gestation, it seems logical that it could have other functions outside the womb while it continues to pulse.
Also, in trapping all that blood in the placenta, doesn't that make it more difficult to deliver the placenta? I mean,
after you've done clamping, you either take the blood and you store it for stem cell collection, or you just let it dump it, go into the bag that's on the end of the bed. I never deliver a placenta even after I've finally clamped it with the cord still on it. I basically let the blood run out of it. So I don't know if that's the case.
I see.
But that blood is valuable to the baby. And while the baby's practicing breathing on the mother's tummy, why can't it be getting oxygen from two sources? Why can't it be getting volume from two sources? I mean, if a baby is born slightly depressed and we clamp the cord right away, we're depriving the baby of kind of red cells, which means oxygen and volume. And the first thing they do when the baby's taken over to the warmer is give the baby oxygen and volume.
What's interesting to me is, as I've interviewed people, nurses, different nurses will give me different scientific-based protocols for what they're supposed to do. And here locally in Columbia, Missouri, I heard a story that a nurse told a woman that she could not, they would, could not leave the cord intact because the baby could die from too much blood. This is a nurse.
Yep. Well, I'm sure she was told that someplace.
Well, I think people really need to understand that obstetrics doesn't have a standard of care. Like, there's a perfect example. It's what you're trained. It's the hospital you're at. At your hospital, you can't do breech. At one hospital, you can do VBACs. At another one, you can't. It's kind of crazy.
And I guess some of this early cord clamping arises. Janelle, you mentioned in a previous show that it came out of the ether days,
right,
where they wanted to keep the baby from getting too much ether through the umbilical cord.
Well, the mother was out during the knock 'em out, drag 'em out era.
Yeah.
Yeah, if they were to just to take a look at nature and just take a step back for a second and realize that somebody said earlier on, I mean, it's millions of years, one of you guys said this earlier, that, I mean, there's been thousands and thousands and thousands of years of evolution to get to a point where suddenly we need to have a metal clamp, clamp the cord, and that's that. I mean, that's not how nature, if nature intended the cord to stop after the baby was born, they would have had the placenta fall out or the cord fall off or something would have happened. There would have been an evolutionary reason for it that would have been beneficial, and there's not. So it's just common sense thinking, once again, that just seems to be under attack for the reasons I've said before. I mean, ignorance, fear, economics. And only, you know, talk shows like yours, the Internet has been great in getting the word out because, you know, more and more patients, I think, are becoming enlightened. But, again, we do live in a fear-based society. If you put pregnancy in a Google search, I mean, the first million hits are going to be probably things that are bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's like putting an airplane in Google search. You're not going to find, anything positive in the first 10 pages of Google search. It'll all be about hijackings and crashes and other things like that, because that's what people talk about. That's what spreads. Normal doesn't make the news.
Well, and I need to take a little break here. I'm actually so involved here, I didn't realize how late it's getting already. Just want to let people know that this is 89.5 FM Columbia, Missouri, and we're Thought Crime Radio, the voices for the human rights of babies, and we're talking to Dr. Stuart Fishbein from the Los Angeles area. And we'll be back in just a moment. And when we come back, Dr. Fishbein, maybe you could give us information about your website and why the name of the website and what you're doing out in L.A. Tell us about what you're doing that's the right way. You could do that?
Sure, and then we can get on to informed consent, I think, right?
Right.
Okay.
Guitarist Django Reinhardt, featuring a performance by Mark O'Connor and his band Hot Swing at the Missouri Theater on January 21st at 7 p.m. More information and tickets available at Ticketmaster, WeAlwaysSwing.org, or 449-3001.
We'll get it sometime here. The Tree Keepers are a group of trained volunteers who help the City of Columbia with planting, tree care, and various other projects. Tree keepers attend a free course in tree management, including information on identification, planting, pruning, and diseases. In exchange, participants are asked to volunteer 36 hours working on projects for the city. The first of three training sessions begins on Tuesday, January 26th at the ARC, 1701 West Ash Street. That's the ARC, I guess. More information is at 874-7499.
All righty. So welcome back, Dr. Fishbein. Tell us about your practice and give us information about your website.
Okay, my website is www.supportdoctor, that's D-R, Fishbein with a C in it, F-I-S-C-H-B-E-I-N, .com. And then I blog off of that as well. And I formed the website, several months ago when it became apparent that my ability to practice medicine as I've been trained and am qualified to do and has served me well over the years in collaboration with midwives was kind of under attack by the established community of small group of physicians who tend to have been running that department for the, as long as I've been in the Ventura County area. And they systematically began regulating, writing protocols, restricting choices that really belong to women, and are technically in violation of the hospital's own mission statement, which is on their website under Catholic Healthcare West. So when I had done those VBACs and breaches back in June, and again, they were not something where I told them they had to come to me. I gave them choices, and they chose to stay in their community, deliver at their community hospital, and they wanted to stay with me. As I said, they couldn't come down to the hospital, so they came down on me, and they threatened my privileges. They basically told me that if I did another VBAC or a breach delivery, that I would be suspended, even though it's really not my choice to to do that. So I've had to turn a lot of women away from my practice who normally would have been referred to me for these options, because I obviously have to continue to make a living, and so I have to continue to practice. So I've been trying in some ways to write letters and fight them working within the system, and it has been futile because they don't even respond to most of the things that I say, and tend to read my blog, and if I do say something that is factual, they tend to yell at me for doing that. So it is a system where it's really untenable because I really can't practice that way, and so it's a system where, you know, if I can't join them and I can't beat them, then I have to find an alternative. And so we're looking at an alternative option. And along with several other people in the country, we're trying to come up with this option, which is a third choice for birth between home birth and between hospital-based medical birth. And that would be to have a center that's a birthing center that has tubs and is a natural birth center that actually is connected to or adjacent to a surgical center-type place where you could have a cesarean section if necessary. And that way you could be treated, and again, so the whole purpose of my website is to just inform people. Hopefully people will click on it, go back in time, read from the beginning all the way through to currently, and just check some of the issues that have been going on, because this is the future for our children, our daughters. They either have an ever-climbing cesarean section rate and all that it entails, heading, you know, up to closing in on 33% now. It's going to probably be 40% within 10 years, unless we can turn things around. And I think if we give women women a choice of a third option. Some women are afraid to have home birth, but they would really like to deliver in a setting, as long as they know there's some safety down the hall. But we weren't bound by the ridiculous rules of the bureaucrats that run hospitals. I think it would be a very good option, and I'm hoping that we could find, and if anybody's listening, what we really need right now is benefactors. We need people who can help raise money or who want to donate to open up facilities like this around the country.
People need to know that ACOG and other obstetrical organizations around the world are pressuring governments to pass laws to make midwifery illegal.
Not only midwifery illegal, but they've already made it very difficult to do any sort of midwifery model practice, because midwives by law in just about every state, there are some states that aren't this way, but I know in California a midwife has to have a physician as a supervisor, not necessarily a backup, but as a supervisor. But if the medical malpractice carriers are pressured, or if the hospitals are pressured to tell their physicians that they cannot back midwives, or we won't insure you, or we won't allow you on staff, then doctors who still have to make a living will have to stop backing midwives, and midwives will end up not being able to practice in the state of California, not because there's a law against them, but just because they can't comply with the laws that already exist. It's really a sneaky little way around things that only public outcry.
This amounts to institutionalized child abuse.
But public outcry is right.
Yeah,
they're not going to listen to me, and they're not going to listen to you guys probably, and they're not going to. They will listen for the, you know, if you can influence people to call in, but they're not going to listen to midwives, and they're not going to listen to nurses.
Well, it's the public. It's people that are giving birth. It's people that know of other people who are giving birth that we're actually trying to reach, because we do want to create that public outcry. And what really strikes me about what you're saying is that, you know, I've been in the natural birth field in quotes for a decade, and to hear, you know, the anti-doctor bashing and the anti-OB bashing, and to hear you talk, you're in the same position. You don't have any power within the system, and you're the doctor. I think people need to hear that.
Right.
That's
right.
Huge.
Yeah, practicing physicians, what you would call grunts in the military, okay, don't have really any real power. The power in medicine comes from academia and big institutions, things like Kaiser, Catholic Healthcare West, Stanford, you know, Harvard, Cedars-Sinai. Those big institutions, they have full-time faculty, and those faculty can then go and lobby Sacramento or lobby Washington or sit on committees, because you know what? They're getting paid. their salary anyway. They don't have an overhead to meet. They don't have people do.
Some of them get all kinds of money from pharmaceutical companies and other vested interests in the field.
And I know you'll answer this with greed because Rich just answered it. But Stuart, why when we know what we know about the safety of women and babies, is this allowed in the legislature? I mean, how are these professors allowed to go and do that?
Well, for the most part, and again, this is not to diminish all people in the legislature, but when it comes to medical stuff, they don't know anything, okay? So they get their advice from people in the medicine. Now, people in medicine who have time to give advice to these people are all academically linked or big business linked. For instance, the American Medical Association, all right, has a reputation. If you talk to anybody in the country, they've all heard of it. And they think it represents doctors. But the American Medical Association represents less than 17% of physicians in this country. And most of the physicians who belong to the AMA are either in academic medicine, retired, or residency. Right? I don't know, I'll be honest with you, I don't know a single practicing physician who I keep in touch with who belongs to the American Medical Association. So when the AMA goes and endorses the health care plan, which is a whole other issue for another day, they're not representing the 80-some percent of us that are out there actually doing the work every day. People don't know that.
Doesn't the AMA itself get all kinds of funding from corporate interests?
I'm assuming they do. I can't comment on that. They're supposed to be a nonprofit organization. They're not supposed to be a political organization. They're not supposed to. They're supposed to get their tax exempt status by not lobbying for certain things. But I'm not exactly sure. There's a lot of gray area there, and I really don't understand that. And again, that's not something I care to understand. I'd rather just be left alone and allowed to do what I know how to do.
Yeah, but the average person out there needs to know that the entire system has gotten thoroughly corrupt. I mean, the American, I don't know about the AMA in particular, but I know that the American Psychiatric Association gets, you know, millions of dollars from pharmaceutical companies, indirectly, that finances their conferences, their publications, and so on.
You know, Rich, I assume that that's true with just about every aspect of our lives these days.
Yeah.
And I just think that the average person just gets overwhelmed with that stuff. But I think that healthcare does touch everyone. You know, big oil touches everyone, banks touch everyone, politics. I mean, in everything that we do, there's conspiracy theory everywhere. And I think a lot of them are based in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you're saying is absolutely true about the medical profession. The problem is, what can the average person do about it? And the average person can do nothing about it.
And what can a child do? You know, a child is subject to the incompetence of their parent. You know, their parents don't know what's going on. And
well, it would be nice if a woman could choose to not have invasive procedures done on her when she's giving birth for no reason.
Well, if they had the information,
that would be a
Janelle,
good start.
Then they could make the choice.
Well,
the problem is that they don't ever get. Don't I shouldn't say ever, because again, I don't want to paint everybody with a broad brush. But they generally don't get true informed consent on any topic. Every health care practitioner has a bias. That's human nature, and it's our job to try to keep our bias in check when we counsel a patient regarding their medical options. But when a doctor's occupation or a doctor's job is dependent on doing things a certain way, then it's only natural, it's not right, but it's only natural to skew your counseling to get the patient to follow the path that you want them to follow. And we have immense power as physicians over the patient population, and it's abused regularly because people are being told, for instance, in the vaginal birth after cesarean world, when they're counseled by somebody who either doesn't want to do VBAC, doesn't allow VBAC, their hospital doesn't allow VBAC, they'll just tell them, well, if you have a vaginal birth after cesarean, you could rupture your uterus and your baby could die. And if that's all you heard, then as a woman, you'd be crazy to have a vaginal birth. But there's much more to the story than that, but that's not what they're being told for a myriad of reasons. And that's wrong. Even if this doctor doesn't do VBAC, it's his obligation counsel patients that it's an option and that they can't get it here, you should seek it out elsewhere. But that would be doctors cutting their own throats. And, you know, we are, we do have a business to run, too.
Wow.
This is a
I'm not justifying it. I know Rich is probably chopping his bit over
there. No.
Just sitting
no.
here going, hmm.
It's like, you know, this is a picture of total breakdown.
So the question is, how do you fix it? I mean, let's talk a little bit more, just briefly, about the skewed informed consent. I mean, patients need to be wise consumers. They need to, again, all we can do is educate them one at a time, and hopefully they'll spread the word to their friends, and that radio stations like yours, websites like mine or ICANN's website or the Birth Action Coalition out here where I work, or there's lots and lots of links on my website. It's got a lot of links to other supportive websites. There's YouTube videos and stuff that can educate people so that they can ask the right questions. And what I tell people more than anything else, the most important thing you can have when you're pregnant or with any physician is a trusting bond with that practitioner. And if you don't trust the words that are coming out of their mouth, then you need to find another practitioner. That's absolutely, and you need to do that. And you need to be able to ask questions, and if you feel like you're being blown off, you need to find another practitioner.
Well, okay. I think it's horrible that you have the skills and the common sense and then the wisdom, and you know how to provide the care that these women want, and they can't get it because of the system. So we need to keep getting this information out.
Well, there are women that are choosing to have VBACs at home or even breaches at home because they know that if they show up at any institution, the likelihood of them having a successful outcome to what they want is pretty much zero, or they can't even find a like-minded practitioner anywhere within 100 miles. So they stay home. Now, that isn't necessarily the best thing for them to be doing, but what choice do they have?
I know of a woman who gave birth while fending off nurses. She was standing on top of her bed. You know, the nurses were trying to get her to lay down, and she obviously knew what she was doing because she stayed in the upright position, but she had to fight these nurses off so she could deliver her baby.
And she was still able to give birth. That's what's really amazing about us humans.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you'd like to think that labor progresses more naturally in a nurturing environment, and here's a woman who has to fight, but obviously it went anyway. I mean, you're right. I mean, laying on your back has been the standard birthing position since I've been in medicine. But it's by far not the best position to be in. It sometimes makes it easier to, you know, protect the perineum, I have to say, at the time of delivery than when someone's on all fours or squatting. But ultimately, nature has not designed a woman to deliver flat on her back.
Mm-mm.
And it's certainly not, you know, they need to get up, move the pelvis, rock the pelvis. I mean, the reason a lot of babies get stuck sideways or looking up at the wrong direction is because women aren't moving in labor. They need to be moving. They need to be in the shower. They need to be having their backs rubbed. They need to rock their hips back and forth, go for a walk. And those violate hospital protocols because they can't monitor you. They can't take your blood pressure every 10 minutes. They can't stick a thermometer in your mouth because it's so important. They have to have these numbers to fill in the blanks.
This would be hilarious if it wasn't so tragic.
Well, it is tragic. I mean, I'll tell you...
We're laughing, but it's not funny.
Let me tell you a little side story about this computer inputting, okay? You know, computer, everything's going electronic medical records, and so, you know, everything has to be put in the computer, and so sometimes the nurses are so busy putting in the computer that they don't even make eye contact with the patient.
Hmm.
So there's no eye contact going on. And I will tell you one time, this is an absolutely true story. I was in the delivery room, and there was, I was doing a cesarean section with my partner, and the nurse had her back to us, typing in the computer as we're going along. And I'm taking a look, and there were some nursing students at the foot of the bed, and they were watching. And I took a look at one of the nursing students, and she was turning ghastly white. Okay? So I called the nurse's names several times. And she did not turn around, and she just said, "Wait a minute, Dr. Fishbein, wait a minute, Dr. Fishbein." And finally, I yelled a little loudly. She turned around, and boom, the nurse hit the floor. All right, but my nurse was so busy typing stuff into the computer as we were delivering the baby that she wasn't paying any attention to what was going on in the room. Okay, because they have to get this paperwork. It's not even paperwork. This computer entry done. I have nursing friends at my hospital who tell me that, you know, they'll deliver a baby, and that takes 10 minutes to deliver the baby, and they'll spend an hour and 15 minutes afterwards doing the paperwork for the delivery. Meanwhile, the mother, who's a new mother, doesn't have a nurse to help her with latching on or any of the other stuff because the nurse is sitting at the desk typing into the computer. This is the this is the wonderful future of medicine, and it's only going to get worse as the bean counters need to keep counting every single bean that goes on.
Yeah,
and the defensive medicine, the need.
Well, there's the electronic medical records bill that's coming down the road. That by 2014, I think it is, every doctor's office is going to have to be on electronic medical records, meaning that solo chiropractors, solo acupuncturists, anybody that either bills insurance or does anything like that will not be able to function without spending a fortune on the hardware, and then another $5,000 to $10,000 a year probably on software updates, because it creates a new cottage industry for companies to make software for this stuff and constantly change it so that you have to constantly reorder it. Talk about conspiracy theories there, Rich. This is one, this is something where, I think GE lobbied heavily for this bill, and then GE is an Obama supporter, is likely to get a very large contract, which is worth billions of dollars, to help deal with the mega information that's going to be coming in once everybody's online with this system. And it really is going to do nothing to improve health care.
Yeah. Meanwhile, babies are crying their eyes out in distant nurseries.
Yeah, all by themselves in some warmer someplace with some a shot in their butt and some drops in their eyes.
And they're not getting any, not only are they not getting breastfed, they're not getting the tactile sensory input, they're not getting the mobility. These are things that have been proven to be associated with...
Well, just look at the difference between a baby that's screaming in the nursery and the one that's laying on his mother's chest.
Yeah.
We talk about this all the time. If you look at it, you can see it.
Yes.
But they've done primate studies of monkeys that are raised with and without this kind of sensory input. And,
would be on antidepressants.
Exactly. I mean, these monkeys turn psychotic, when subjected to the, an extreme form of what they do in nurseries.
What I would tell your listeners, again, is to fight for an alternative. Because it's almost impossible that hospitals will change. Hospitals are not going to change their spots. They're only going to get worse. They only react like governments react. Despite all their rules and regulations and policies, something will still go wrong, and then they'll create new rules, regulations, and policies to ride over the old rules, regulations, and policies, and it will be so our heads will be spinning. What we need is an alternative where women can give birth in the manner to which it was intended, with the idea that safety is just around the corner, but not, not stuck to into their arm and on their chest and around their abdomen constantly.
Right.
And that's what I would. That's the message that I would send to people out there, is to look into these options, help support people that are pro these options, support midwives, support midwifery, support birthing centers, support those few physicians like me who are out there. And I'm not even talking monetarily. I'm just talking, with letters of support, letters to your local politicians, letters to your hospital complaining. If you know somebody that's on the board of a hospital, because a lot of hospital boards have no idea what's going on. They're only told by their administrators what's going on, and the administrators only tell them what they want them to hear.
Right.
So, board members who can actually make a difference. And every board member has either a daughter or a wife or a woman in their family who's going to end up suffering if things don't change.
Absolutely. And, we are out of time already. I can't believe it.
I knew this would happen.
I know. And that's why we plan to have you 3 weeks in a row, because you have so much to share with us. And so we will be talking to you again next week.
And we will link to your website from our website. Our website is thoughtcrimeradio.blogspot.com.
And I really appreciate you being here, Dr. Fishbein, and I want to let people know before we leave that I know some people out there, and I know a doula who said that you are the only physician that she refers to.
Right, and now I'm limited in the fact that what I can do for her, which is really a shame.
The people who really want to see women empowered, that want to see women have a healthy and safe birth and have a connected birth with their baby.
And happy families.
Yeah. Yeah, they see the value in what you're doing and doctors like you, and we really honor you and appreciate you, and we look forward to talking to you next week.
Well, it's lovely every now and then to be sitting around the campfire with like-minded people, so thank you for saying that, because sometimes you just feel like you're fighting the battle all by yourself.
It's actually,
no, we got your back.
It's actually 2 weeks. 2 weeks from now.
2 weeks from now? Oh, yeah. Yes. I'm so sorry. It's 2 weeks from now because we are not here on the first Monday.
And that'll be the same time.
Same time.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay.
This is Thought Crime Radio.
We are the voices.
We're the human rights
of babies. I'll get that right.
Join us in 2 weeks.